to round three of Profs and Pints, where tonight I'm very happy to present tonight's discussion on blurred boundaries of humanity. So tonight we're asking the question, what does it mean to be human when science mixes it up with animals and technology? So the profs to help us out this evening, to weave us around these ethical conundrums in light of technological, biological and artistic evolution. We have Oren Katz, a tissue engineering artist, co-founder and director of Symbiarca. Please make him welcome. And Dr. Mike Alder from the University of Western Australia Mathematics and Statistical Department, where he spends his time trying to work out how our brains work. And Professor Alan Harvey from the Anatomy and Human Biology Department at UWA, where his research focuses on the use of cell and tissue transplantation and gene therapy. And he's also trying to write a book on music, neuroscience and evolution. Thank you very much, everyone. Let's make him feel welcome. So let's launch ourselves into the banter, into boundaryless world, and explore where humanity lies. Everyone, I'd like you to once again welcome Oren Katz. Your microphone's there. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. As you said, Renee, I'm not a scientist. I'm an artist, and I would qualify myself, my first provocation, as an artist, I feel that engineers are taking over. And I feel that the single engineering paradigm that is really starting to dominate our life, basically trying to engineer matter through nanotechnology, trying to engineer life through synthetic biology, and trying to engineer our thoughts through neuroengineering, is something that we have to get a little bit worried about, and hopefully we'll explore it further. And going to China and seeing this human engineering lab in a place where artists, science and engineers were supposed to work together had a chill running through my back, and I decided to join the board of that organization. So what happens when you engineer life? How those boundaries blur? As an artist working with living tissue, and as a tissue engineering artist, as you pointed out, for the last 15 years, I was constantly confronted by the fact that it's really not humans that are of interest, it's life itself. Because when you start to engage with life in those different levels, humans have no significant place. And it's really about the context. For example, the work of a scientist called Erwin Weissmann, who's in the late 20th century, the beginning of this century, started to engineer mice that had a large percentage of their cells in the brains human. He then went to the Californian Ethics Board to try and get an approval to create a mouse that had 100% of their brain cells humans. And the questions there was how they would know if it's ethically right or not, and one of the responses was, once the mouse starts to express humanness, and what is this humanness, no one was able to answer. And they decided to allow him to do experiments where it's about 10 to 15% cells, which are human cells, within the mouse brain. Then there's the issue of co-culturing cells. And quite a lot of our work, I suppose you won't see that, but that's one of our works that Yonad Zorin and myself developed since 2004, where we grow in a small jacket in a technological body where mouse and human cells are grown together inside a technological body. And this type of technological body is really what we are all in at the moment. And the more the engineers would take over, the more technological our body was going to be. And where's that going to leave us when we know now that mice can have human brains, when we can put human nucleus inside cows' ovaries in order to create so-called ethical stem cells, although I'm sure you'll have something to say about that. Where is that really going to leave us? And where it leaves us as people who are not engineers or sometimes not scientists to deal with those issues? Are we going to live the decisions, are we going to live the way in which the knowledge that we acquire, which I have nothing against, but I have a problem with the way we are deciding how this knowledge is being applied, are those decisions going to be left only to people who consider themselves experts, or we have a voice there as well? And I'll leave it there. Thanks.
All righty, I'm now going to kick it over to Dr. Mike. Thank you very much, Mike.
Hi, guys. I'm going to do something truly dreadful. I'm going to talk about myself. This is against every principle I've got, but I'm more or less compelled to. And the reason is this. I'm not used to public speaking except in slabs of 45 minutes about mathematics. And something tells me I'd better not try that tonight. Now, the other thing is that I'm used to talking with pictures. I'm used to being given a blackboard and a bunch of colored chalks, or maybe a whiteboard and some colored pens. They've not let me have that. So I'm totally stuffed. So I'm going to have to change the sort of the subject that I'm usually familiar with, and I'm going to talk about me. Now, my interest in science started, I suppose, when I was about 9 or 10 years old. And I became interested, first of all, in astronomy. I remember looking up at the starry skies one summer night and being just awestruck by it. The lights up there in the sky looking down, and perhaps more important, the black spaces, the huge amount of nothingness. Pascal is supposed to have said he was frightened by all that nothingness, but I didn't find it frightening. I found it awe-inspiring. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork, was the line of the psalmist. And although I'd been an atheist for 2 years by then, so I thought that was a bit vulgarizing things, really, but I understood the kind of place he was coming from. Now, that sort of gradually evolved. I found out, as I learned more about the world, that there were other incredibly wonderful things in it, too. I realized, for instance, that a single leaf from a single tree is an incredibly complex chemical factory for turning sunlight into energy. And the fact that it's so small and so insignificant for us doesn't mean that it's any the less wonderful and less marvelous. If there were only one tree in the world and only one leaf on that tree, people would come across the entire planet just to look at it because it's so utterly wonderful. But as it happens, there are an awful lot of trees, an awful lot of leaves, and we get rid of them with blowers. That's part of being a scientist, I think, is that you look at the world and you see wonders where other people don't, because they don't know enough, or perhaps they haven't thought enough. My third epiphany, I suppose, was when I was about 14 or 15. And I read a science fiction book by Isaac Asimov, well, three science fiction books, the Foundation Trilogy. And that really was a life-changing business. What happens in the book is that there's a mathematician called Harry Seldon who, applying mathematics to societies, can predict when they're going to rise and when they're going to fall and what's going to happen. In particular, he can forecast the end of his own society, the pan-galactic empire that he's living in. Now, this idea is, like most ideas in science fiction, highly derivative. It actually comes from the German Oswald Spengler and the English historian Arnold Toynbee. They claimed that they could see patterns in history and how things came and went. Asimov's contribution was, first of all, to dramatize this so that a teenage kid could be moved by it, and also to add one crucial ingredient, which was the mathematics. It was clear to me, looking at books on history and books on sociology, that sociology simply was not a science. It wasn't then, and it still isn't. So I decided at age 15 that I was going to be Harry Seldon. I was going to understand these things properly. I was going to turn social science into a real science. And that, in a sense, has been influencing everything I've done ever since. Now, the first step that I took has been a sequence of steps, I guess, and the very first one happened only within a couple of months. I discovered that I had to constrain my ambitions rather severely. And it happened this way. There's an analogy which is put in the books by Asimov, which goes something like this. You need a galactic empire with billions and billions and squillions and gazillions of people in it because you want to apply statistical methods. If you apply statistical methods, then the fact that you don't know diddly squat about a single individual doesn't matter. And the analogy was drawn with statistical thermodynamics. Now, thermodynamics is about gases and pressure and temperature and stuff like that and what happens when you change them. And statistical thermodynamics gives a kind of foundation to it, which came second. And what it does is it looks at what happens if you've got a can with a bunch of molecules in it, gazillions of molecules. And each molecule is basically like a little billiard ball, and it goes shooting around the place. And you can describe your billiard ball with six numbers. Three numbers are going to tell you where it is, and another three numbers are going to tell you where it's going and how fast it's going. Now, that gives you space, as we mathematicians say, of dimension six. And six is a reasonably small number. And we've got another consideration, which is the kinds of interactions that can happen between these things. Every molecule is just a point in that six-dimensional space. And the only kinds of interactions you can have between molecules are basically that they bounce off each other elastically, like little billiard balls. Now compare the situation with societies. With a society, what you've got is that you don't know how many numbers it's going to take to specify a single element in that society, a single human being. The only thing we can say with any confidence is going to be a hell of a lot more than six. Now, what's going on there? Well, we don't know what the state space is. We don't know what its dimension is. All we know is that if there is one, it's huge. So the analogy falls apart. We simply can't use statistics because we don't know the basics of what the space is. And the other thing, of course, is the interactions. Now, the interactions between any two molecules are very straightforward. Like I say, they just bounce. You want to come and take over, kid? You can be pretty confident that there's a hell of a lot more interactions between two human beings than just having them bounce off each other. And the trouble is, we cannot say anything much about these. I mean, we do it in English, but you can't say much about it in mathematics because we just don't know the details. We can't explain it. Now, having confronted this awful truth about 3 months after my decision that I was going to be Harry Seldon, I realized that I wasn't going to be able to be Harry Seldon because there was a prior job that required me to understand people first. So I narrowed my scope from all of societies to just understanding a human being. Well, it gets worse. I mean, there's not much prospect of understanding a human being if you can't understand, say, a cat or a dog. So I went down gradually. I got down to ants. I thought if I could understand ants, I'd be doing pretty damn well. When I say understanding ants, what I mean is something like this, because you could understand an ant in several different senses. You could understand its anatomy, physiology, the way it's made. But I'm interested in the information processing aspects of it. An ant has got senses. It's got eyes. It's got little whiskery things. And it's got effectors. It's got legs. It's also got something which connects them. Now, this is pretty much what a robot is. A robot also will have sensors, typically something like, say, a video camera. It's got effectors, possibly arms and legs or wheels or something. And it's got to have something that connects them, a program that goes in between these two things. And so that's what I mean when I say understanding what an ant is or what an animal is or even what an organism is. I mean, we can talk about, say, a cabbage plant. A cabbage plant senses the gravity field and works out which way is down. And that's how it knows to grow the roots, that way and not that way. You don't see many cabbages upside down. So cabbages have got it figured out. Well, I've got down to bacteria, and now I'm gradually on the way up again. It's it's going to be a long time before I get to people, I can tell you. So when it comes to asking what is it to be human, I've got a very straightforward answer to that. I don't have the foggiest idea. I'm not at all sure I should be here tonight. I'm relying heavily on the fact that you're going to be pissed pretty shortly, so it won't matter. there's an interesting... What I have done is to construct a kind of mathematical formalism in which one can talk about these things. It's got certain assumptions built into it, and they could be turn out to be wrong. Well, that's life. But it all has already led to being able to focus on a rather interesting issue. And it's an issue that just wouldn't have occurred to people, I think, if they were not looking at it from a mathematical point of view. If you look at it from just natural language, what I'm going to say is just going to look really weird. Well, that's the whole charm of mathematics anyway. We like weird. If it's a choice between boring and weird, give us weird every time. Now, what it is this. If you take a robot and you put a camera on it, what it sees is basically a bunch of numbers. If you take a little grayscale image, and I'm taking grayscale just for simplicity, then what it is if it's, say, a 1,000 by 1,000 pixels, then that's a big stack, a rectangular array, what we call a matrix, and inside each pixel there's a number saying how bright it is. 0 is black, 255 is white, and any other number in between. If you want a color image, you have 3 grayscale images, one for red, one for blue, and one for green is the usual way of looking at it. Now, what the computer sees, as I say, is a big stack of numbers. Now, you look around, and what do you see? You see things. You see people. You see tables and bottles and glasses. Where do they come from? You see, your eye is doing pretty much what the video camera does. Every retinal cell is going to be responding to the amount of light falling in on it by a spike frequency coming out at the back, which can be measured by a number. So you, too, are taking all those numbers and you're somehow extracting things. And this is a very clever trick. Now, this doesn't happen just with human eyes. It happens with any eye, pretty much. You've got this business of thing extraction. If you take a 5-year-old kid and you give it, say, 100 images, let's make them grayscale images, and 50 of them are little old ladies and 50 of them are trees, and you just give them in a bundle and you say, sort them, kid. It can do it. It can pick them out and it can work out which ones are the pictures of little old ladies and which ones are the trees. And it will get pretty much the same answer as any other 5-year-old and pretty much the same answer as you. Now, this is a very clever trick, and we don't know how to do it. Now, it should be possible to write a program which will take some of these, well, 100 images, half of them little old ladies and half of them trees, and work out which is which. I mean, after all, it's numbers. It's got to do something with those numbers. What it's going to be doing is, well, it's going to be following some algorithm, some principle that we just do not understand. Now, you get programmers, and they can actually do this job. They sit down, they do it as follows. They sit down, they look at the images, they look at a handful of them, and they think, how do I do it? What is it about these images that I'm using? And then they try to extract that information. And when they finish, they get something like 70% of the score of a 5-year-old kid, if you're lucky. And it could take them a year to write a program like that. Now, you go to the 5-year-old kid, and you give him some more pictures, and this time half of them are aeroplanes and half of them are fish, and you say, sort those, and the kid just does it. And you go to the program, and you give it the aeroplanes and the fish, and it screws up big time, because it can only do little old ladies and trees. So there's a very fundamental difference between these two approaches. Now, the one of them is just, as I said, it's using the information in the human head to try to do this job. About 50 years ago, people were saying how By the end of the 20th century, we would never have to do any work ever again. All the work would be done underground by robots, and we'd be lolling about in hammocks, and we'd be able to call out to the robots, bring me a daiquiri, and it would do it. Well, it hasn't happened. It doesn't look as if it's going to happen. Why isn't it happening? Why didn't it happen? Well, those things were written by journalists and people like that who don't actually know anything about science. And sorry, Renee. And they didn't realize that there were very deep and very fundamental problems involved, which we didn't even know how to state properly, let alone solve. You can see that this problem is a practical problem. I mean, it would revolutionize the whole business of automation. It would change society incredibly if this problem could be solved. Now, I should perhaps put in a little disclaimer here. While it is probably true that if we manage to make headway with this problem and solve it, we can be fairly confident that it's going to make some rich, fat businessman even richer and fatter. And I wouldn't want you to think that that's why I'm doing it. Because it ain't going to make me richer or fatter. Now, this brings me to the big problem of why exactly I'm here tonight, which I have not yet solved. What is humanity? I have to say, I do not have the foggiest idea. What is it to be human? I don't know. I don't understand people. They're much, much, much too complicated. I don't understand myself in particular, and it's worse there because I've got additional information. I know what it feels like on the inside, and that is even more confusing. And I'm a deeply confused person, I can tell you. I explained to some of my students, to be a deeply confused person is perfectly normal and acceptable. In fact, over here in the art, in the sciences, we're deeply confused. But over there in the arts, they're even more deeply confused because they don't know they're deeply confused. Sorry about that. Now, what can we say about the other side of it, about our human nature, about meddling in what we are? I think I've only got one observation about this, which is that so long as there have been human beings, which is maybe coming up to 250,000 years, depending on what you count as human, we've been putting our grubby little hands and meddling with everything we've been able to get them on. And I don't see any reason why we're going to stop now.
Fantastic, thank you. Thank you so much, Michael. I suppose the short answer is to move forward on working out who we are and what we're actually doing. You need to have a nice philosophical look backwards, and I think that's absolutely what you've provided tonight. Professor Alan Harvey, everyone, please give him a great big round of applause. I have no idea what he's bringing to the table, so let's see what you got.
I'm going to change the tenor of the discussion just slightly, and really it's a question of finding out what you think. So I'm going to sort of pose a bunch of questions, and they come from the fact that I'm in a human biology school at uni. I was trained as a neurophysiologist, I suppose. And it's interesting how you define yourself. You asked whether you're a scientist or an artist or an engineer. When someone asked me in the pub, what do I do? When I was in my mid-20s, it was not a good look if a woman asked me what I did and I said I was a neuroscientist, because I didn't really get another word in. They sort of moved off somewhere else. So I spent a long time trying to think, what did I do? If I said I was a musician, that was maybe a bit different. I've been all those things. But am I human? I suppose I am. And the reason that's an important question is because I think we've missed one basic question, which is how do you define human in the first place? There are a number of ways you can define human. And I actually think that question is probably the most dangerous question that's ever existed, since we've had language. Because you can use it as an excuse to do anything you like, depending on how you define human. You can define it spiritually, You can define the term spiritually. You can define it from a cultural perspective, or you can define human biologically. But if you're defining human biologically, what is the definition? Is it merely the genome? Is that the definition? Or is it something that is cognitive? Is it something that relates to behavior, activity? And if you're not sure how you define human, then, as I've said, you can end up in all sorts of places that many of us would find sources of argument and sometimes controversy. So, for example, depending on how you define human, you have issues of race and ethnicity. You have issues of genocide, depending on how you define human. You have issues of embryonic stem cells, of embryo experimentation, of IVF, of abortion. You have issues of infanticide. You have issues of euthanasia. You have issues of modern medical transplantation in terms of transplanting tissues between individuals. You have issues that relate to artificial intelligence and the interface between humans and machines. All of those really depend on how you define human. Now, my definition of human, having thought about this in the last several hours, is really has to be relates to the genome and nothing else. Because if you actually start to think of it in different ways, you can end up in all sorts of ethical minefields. I spent 10 years on the Reproductive Technology Council here in Perth and spent 10 years grappling with issues of IVF, of surrogacy, of embryo experimentation, of spare embryos. There are thousands and thousands of spare embryos frozen in this state, an issue of what to do with them. Are they human? Is an ongoing debate. If you get to a situation where you define human in a non-genomic way, then you have the sort of thing that Peter Singer talks about in his book Rethinking Life and Death, where he talks about, and he actually, one of his colleagues wrote a book about infanticide, because he talks a little bit about preferences that you on balance you make decisions on the balance of preferences and who has a greater preference to do something or more right to do something than somebody else, and he said that preferences are anything that are either sought or avoided, and they bring satisfaction or frustration, and you have to have a capacity to experience the sensations of satisfaction or frustration to be able to elicit a preference for one thing or another. And he then argued that fetuses, for example, cannot hold any preferences because they do not have the capacity to sense satisfaction or frustration. And he put a figure of about 16 to 18 weeks. And that gets you into all sorts of ethical minefields. If you define human on something other than the genome, if you define it purely on the basis of genetics, then we are probably, modern humans, around about, my guess is about 80,000 years old. That's about it, about 4,000 generations. The skeletons that have been uncovered, the fossils of about 195,000 years, look like Homo sapiens, but my view is that they didn't have language and that their genome was subtly different from ours, because we had some changes that evolved quite rapidly that gave us language and with it modern cognitive architecture. But if you think anything other than the genome, then ask yourself whether a newborn infant has criteria that you could define as being human. On what basis would you define a newborn infant as human? On what basis would you define someone in a coma as human? On what basis would you define someone who's demented and unable to do anything other than be fed through a tube as human? You start getting into all sorts of messes. If you then ask a question about a mouse, which has got 10% of a human brain, no, it's not human. It doesn't have any human behavioural characteristics, but also doesn't carry the human genome. So I'd like you to just think. So my question is, can you help me define what it is to be human? Because based on that definition and your decision on that question, then flows all the other issues that we're discussing. So really, that's all I wanted to say. It was a bit longer than I thought it was going to be. Sorry.
I'm actually going to take it from there and see if we can help come up with something that resembles a definition of what is human. And then if we have our minds grappling around that for a few moments, then we can launch into a few of the other very profound things that have been raised so far. So surely attempting to define humanity can only limit it. And as Professor Alan Harvey's just mentioned, like, where do we go from here? How do we actually define humanity and what is a human?
Okay, my name's Mark and I am an engineer. Okay, so I guess I am...
Is that a confession?
Yes, it is. But I'm a moral engineer, and for me, it's an issue of consciousness. You have to believe you're human. And the topic of consciousness is something that we could talk about all night. What is consciousness? For me, it is a sentient state that you know who you are, you have values, and you believe in those values. You know you're a human. I know I'm a human. I know I have values, and I know that I can think at levels higher than, at a higher level of abstraction than a mouse, for example. Would I be human if someone designed a little transistor that was a good model of a brain cell, and one by one replaced every one of my brain cells with this one of these neurons? At what point would I become a computer? I don't know, 60%. Who knows? But if the models were good enough, I guess I would be self-aware, conscious bunch of transistors, and for me, I would still be human.
So. That's really interesting. I know exactly what Alan's going to say. So, a newborn baby, are they human?
No.
So, what about then the embryos?
I guess it's to
in vitro.
I mean, there's a definition of human, and there's the moral question of whether we have something that we know will be human. Do we allow them to have the same rights that we have, and at what point does that come in? And yeah, as a profound atheist and skeptic, I'm not going to go down that little rabbit hole. But yeah, I think I'll probably just leave it at that for now.
Interesting. Hopefully, yeah, that's opened up a lot of things.
Engineer number one signing off.
Excellent.
I just wanted to raise the question as someone who is involved in philosophy: are we talking about being human or being a person? Because it is one thing to start defining things in terms of, okay, genetically this is human. But if we're going to start talking about personhood and rights, which is something you started to touch upon before, doesn't that expand it a little bit further in terms of what we might consider to be rights given to a person as opposed to given to a human? Because someone could be genetically human and have no brain, no capacity, be essentially, sadly, the equivalent of a vegetable, as horrific as it is to use that term. So I guess maybe that is something that could be taken into consideration. Isn't the word human itself incredibly limiting in this discussion?
I think that it's a nice point, and it raises the question of what is it to be a person and where are you going to draw the lines there? For example, if you meet a little green man from outer space and you can communicate with him, is he a person? I mean, I would say yes. I'm a fairly liberal sort of bloke, so I would have no problem with that. What about an intelligent little green octopus from the Mindanao Deeps? I mean, if that's prepared to laugh at my jokes, I'm prepared to consider it human. Well, not human, but a person. What about an artificial intelligence? Supposing you had a program, a nice big program, and supposing it's learnt to communicate with you and you can hold long conversations with it and discuss philosophy and the like, would it be immoral to pull the plug on the computer? In my view, yes, it would, unless you could save it somewhere and bring it back later.
I take your point, but I was really discussing this in the context of what this whole session was called, which had the word human in the title. And I noticed somebody up there saying definitions are an artificial human creation and always end in semantics. That's absolutely right. But we are having a conversation here which is using language and semantics and syntax and I presume, our intelligence. And the word human is what you wanted us to talk about.
Absolutely.
And the issue of rights, God, yeah, right, okay. Having been on the Reproductive Technology Council for 10 years, I got myself into all sorts of logical convolutions because I was involved in a council that was essentially creating life and using all sorts of modern technology in attempting to create life, which we know now is creating humans that have a greater risk of defects than otherwise. I mean, that's now unequivocal. If you use intracytoplasmic sperm injection, which is where a technician swishes around a dish and picks one sperm that looks nice and then injects that one into the egg because the sperm looked nice and healthy and was vigorous, that's imposing a rather interesting selection criterion on fertilisation. And we're actually bloody lucky that we've got away with it to the extent that we have, in my view. But in that context of this, all these discussions about creating humans, where the decision and the preferences are solely with the parents, we were also discussing issues, or there were things in the media about abortion, where again the issues seem to resolve solely around the parents, and whether or not the a fetus of 8 to 10 weeks is a human or not, or has any rights or not, or is living or not, or is a person or not. My wife is a GP and is firmly in favour of abortion, and so that's an area of a topic that I don't ever go into. So that's why I've used the definition. I've put forward the suggestion that we use the definition of the genome of the genes, so that there's no argument about how you define human, because Peter Singer himself has said, when does an embryo become a human? Based on criteria such as consciousness. If in fact infants are not humans, then that fits exactly with Helga Coos, who's at Monash, who actually thinks there's nothing wrong with it. Well, I shouldn't paraphrase her, but has argued that with that kind of philosophical background, there's therefore nothing necessarily wrong with infanticide. And if, for example, you look in India and China and various places at the imbalance of males to females, it's now well established that female infanticide has been going on at a ferocious rate for at least the last two to three decades.
Can you just define infanticide, what you were saying?
Well, it's killing of an infant.
All right, thank you. Just wanted to clear that up.
Just a comment about that. You can take cells from humans. You can take sexual cells, you can take other cells. You can make them into cell lines, which means you can immortalize them. And you know what it is, and hopefully some of you know. Basically, a technique in which those cells can divide forever. The very first cell line was originated from an African-American woman called Henrietta Lacks in 1951. The cells now, from that person, would fill up this building a few times. The biomass of the biological material, if you like, the genetic material of this person now, 50 or 60 years after her death, way exceeding what it was when she was alive. Is that human? Would you exercise the same kind of moral rights that you talk about, kind of embryos, for example, towards those cells? When we had the victimless letter, and it goes back to your definition also of the potential, but with the victimless letter, for example, when we had to turn it off, the curator of the show at the Museum of Modern Art in New York came up with the statement that she, although she's pro-choice, she lost sleep the night before she had to turn off the life support for a living jacket that was made out of human cells. I'll leave it as an open question.
We can take that as a comment and move on to the next person who'd like to jump on the mic.
I just wanted to redefine the question, actually, about how we're looking at what it is to be human when we're thinking about animals and technology. Because I think what we should be talking about is what happens when you mix the two together, and when does a human stop being human and start being a machine? When you start transplanting pigs' hearts into people and other things, you know, you can grow things off people from other animals. When do they cease to be human? And someone mentioned about having a human brain in a mouse. Does that make them a mouse human, or, you know, can they communicate through technology? Like, not needing to squeak, but they can, like, control the computer with their brain and speak to us. And then do we have to say, well, they're human in a mouse's body?
There's other issues to do with incorporating flesh with machines, and it'd be great to talk about that. But I think putting flesh into flesh just shows the unity we have with other animals and the fact that we are first and foremost animals.
Just want to say, quoting an author that my friend and I were talking about, Donna Haraway, her most recent writing called When Species Meet. In the introduction, she talks about, rather than talking about it as discriminate persons or entities or beings, that she talks about a continuum, that we exist right now with a shared atmosphere of oxygen and carbon dioxide and many other gases, as well as within, living within us and between us are all kinds of bugs and viruses and other species. The title of the book, When Species Meet, is a reality that is present continuously. And so the suggestion being that we are always intermingling, commingling perhaps as far as Alan goes, in a genomic level. And that mixing is always happening, and it is just an arbitrary, much as our semantics are. Quite often, one can argue that those are arbitrary distinctions that we make.
Most of the problems come exactly from this business of a continuum. We get people asking, what is it to be human? Now, imagine a situation in which, instead of our relatively close cousins having died out because probably we ate them, there was in fact a continuum between, say, chimpanzees and human beings. I mean, imagine the problems you'd have if you had them in the schools. But they aren't there, and that's given us the illusion that to be human is something which can be defined. But it isn't. There's a continuum. It's like the colors of the rainbow. Where does red stop and orange start? I mean, this is fundamentally a dumb question. And the question as to what is it to be human is fundamentally dumb in exactly the same way.
Well, shall we wrap it up then? It is a continuum because the definition of human, I suppose, depends on context. I noticed someone up here was saying even the genetic definition is dodgy because you've got mutations and you have polymorphisms and so on and so forth. So within the human species, as it were, there is we're not all identical. That's true. But even if you read Darwin, I think there's some interesting issues in relation to things like origin and the ascent of man, where Darwin is talking about speciation and defining things on the basis of species and the inability to interbreed and so on and so forth. But his comments about humans and savages, for example, and those that are not in Victorian England, I think are quite revealing and indicate that while he was talking about speciation, he also had some other attitudes to what makes a human that were extended far beyond the boundaries of just genes, although of course they didn't know what genes were then, if you understand what I mean. So I think there is a continuum, and it's a contextual one, depending upon whether you're talking about law or whether you're talking about morality or ethics. Here we're talking about engineering, and so I guess I would say in the context of engineering that once a person has a consciousness and knows themselves and knows their own sense of mortality and knows that they have the capacity for free will, for Hal Kolbach, who incidentally is a very fine writer and novelist in his own right. Nice to see you. In that context, then you could imagine that you would remain human if significant parts of you were now engineered. If you had artificial knees, artificial hips, artificial valves, glasses, hearing aid, prosthetics, all sorts. Yeah, Botox.
How far, and that's the question, how far you need to be different from a natural human before you'll have to separate yourself and say, I'm not like that?
My point is to agree with the professor in that it's a continuum, and that if after time most people agree that these people are humans, then that's what makes humanity. You've only got to look at...
So it means that if the non-modified ones would then consider to be non-humans, if most people who are modified would consider themselves being humans, would they consider to be the other, being the other and the non-human?
Yeah, take a leaf out of history. When you look back at the savages, or perhaps the blacks in America in the 1950s, where the whites in America considered those people, the blacks in America, not to be human, but subhuman, it took those people in America to rise up and claim that, no, we feel human. We label ourselves most definitely as humans. We'd like to be considered humans.
I'd probably consider myself more of a creative person than a science-biased person, although I do admire scientists and are constantly asking why and all that. But, I just thought I'd say, biologically, I consider humans, you have to actually be born out of a woman. You have to enter the world as what we consider, like, today as a human, and that from that point onwards, other things can happen, you know, be meddled with, and then you become something else. Like, you might be a slightly enhanced or whatever, but yeah, like, from you're human is when you're born, that you have to come out as a human, sorry, rather than like being, you know, come out in a petri dish or whatever else, yeah, a test tube or whatever, like a conventional birth. And that's something that sort of annoys me a bit about humanity, is we think we're so far removed from being animals. Like, people, we've developed these you know, these customs and these ways of living, but like, other than that, like, we are still animals and we consider ourselves like not part of the actual natural world. And this goes more into like sustainability kind of things, but I just, like, when people, like, they're not prepared to, like, you know, you're out in the bush and you don't want to take a shit in a hole kind of thing, like, just do it. Like, you're a human, you know, you're just an animal. God, like, do you have to come up with all these excuses for not doing things like that? Like, it's just, that just perplexes me. Sorry.
Let me ask you this then. If, at what point do you stop being a human? If there is this continuum and you can do all sorts of things to manipulate us, whether it be by engineering or in other ways throughout life, and there is a sense of continuity that we know ourselves as this unifying conscious being that's progressed through, aware of self, and that in a conscious way, where do we cease becoming human, and where does engineering then cease to be of any value whatsoever in terms of improving life or the quality of life? And I guess I'm getting to something I mentioned at the very beginning of my introduction, which relates to euthanasia. So when you have a significant number of individuals who are now no longer able to communicate with anybody else and are now no longer able to feed themselves, or if we probably don't know whether they actually have any sense of themselves in terms of how we might interpret conscious thought, and that might be a very important thing for neuro people and clinical people to worry about down the track, and ethicists to worry about. But if they show no capacity for self-support, no capacity for any interaction, no capacity for producing speech, for example, and that can happen, to what extent should we still regard these individuals as being on their continuum and throw as much engineering or as much technology or as much cost at these individuals to keep them alive for as long as possible? Yeah, when do they cease being human?
Look, all this stuff about moral consideration. Our moral sense is something that, I guess it's like a sense of humor. It's something you're born with, and it's pretty primitive when you're young, and it gradually evolves as you get older. You look around you and you see people, and you're inclined to hypothesize that they probably are pretty much like you on the inside, because they behave pretty much like you on the outside. And you've been designed, if you like, to have some capacity for empathy. Now, you're taking this capacity for empathy and you're building rather a lot on it. Would you feel that you had empathy for a clone? Well, I don't think you can seriously answer that question until you see it. And the same applies to any extension of humanity. If you take some extensions of humanity that might arise in the very far future, where they don't even look remotely human, maybe they've got, you know, flowers growing out of their skulls, as some of the science fiction writers have suggested. They might look very, very different indeed. I mean, they might have two heads or something. Now, you know, the question is, would you feel empathy with them? And the answer is probably that if you were just to meet them one dark night, you probably wouldn't. I mean, they might look like octopuses or something. But would the people around have some empathy for them? Well, that's much more likely. I mean, how much empathy do you think your remote ancestors, well, he says 80,000 years ago, but that makes mitochondrial Eve somebody who's got no connection with us.
I just wanted to run with empathy just really quickly. Who has had a chance to go to the gallery to see Patricia Piccinini's relativity work? I'm just putting it out there. Her works are all about that merging of science, technology, biological evolution, and what we empathise with. So if you haven't had a chance to see it and you want to learn a little bit more about what it means to be empathetic towards something that is not human, it might be a really interesting exhibit to go and have a look at.
That brings me on to another very interesting issue, actually, which relates to altruism. One of the unique features that has been put forward by a number of different evolutionary biologists relates to what is regarded as a unique feature of this species, which is altruism. And that is an extension of... There's this issue of various relationships where you can... If you take the idea of the selfish gene, the Dawkins idea of the selfish gene, and you extend that towards where you do cooperative acts for your kin, for your family, for those that are genetically related, there's then an advantage for those genes. So they can get to win by acting outside of the specific body in which they're in. But in humans, altruism extends well beyond any genetic relationships. So you can actually perform mutual cooperative altruistic tasks where you mutually benefit each other or you do things for somebody else to your loss, for example. And it's been argued that that is... something that is one group called it a unique outlier in all of evolution.
You can engineer altruism out of human society quite easily, and maybe I want to tie up some of the loose ends here that in kind of a weird way, and give you a little bit of a science history lesson. Back in 1912, there was a scientist called Alexis Carrel, actually a surgeon, who won the Nobel Prize for medicine for finding a new suturing technique, and got a position running a laboratory which was called the Laboratory of Experimental Surgery in the Rockefeller Institute in New York, where he was experimenting with different modes of actually trying to achieve immortality. And he was the one who actually developed the whole field of tissue culture, the understanding you can take cells outside of complex organisms and grow them outside of the body of the organism in this technological body, and developed quite a lot of experiments and was considered to be a pioneer in the field. Then in the 1930s, something very interesting happened to him. He wrote a book called Men the Unknown. Speaking about altruism, he recommended the use of gas chambers to eliminate undesirable elements in human society. And when the Germans invaded France, he went back to France to set up what was called the Institute of Men. He was wiped out of history to some extent. He's being brought back now because of the interesting connection. But at the very same time, in talking about euthanasia and talking about this idea of the technological body, at around the 1930s, when he wrote the book, when he was recommending the use of gas chambers, not just to eliminate the incapacitated, but actually the undesirable, which is different, he also went to a lawyer and consulted with the lawyer what his legal responsibilities towards those who he's bringing back to life, because he believed that he can bring immortality and actually revive people. And he wasn't interested about the ethical consideration. He was interested if they're going to sue him for the fact that he brought them back to life and now he needs to care for their living from now on. So here's a provocation for you.
Ooh, interesting.
How about the notion then that the desire to define ourselves is perhaps the only thing that makes us human? We are all undeniably the species Homo sapien, but it's the society that tries to define what is human. And what is human is a constantly moving target.
Absolutely. Well, Indigenous Australians were classified as part of the flora and fauna landscape when whites first came to this country. So I suppose it's the same thing to the 1960s. Absolutely.
I mean, our remote ancestors would probably look at us with total horror. We don't live up trees and eat our food raw, so we're not truly human. I mean, you make up your definitions from time to time to suit your convenience. But, I mean... There are no sensible answers to these questions.
Just to build on the whole continuum versus categories thing, everybody who looks at the fossil record from an evolutionary perspective sees that there's a progression from habilis to erectus to sapien, but we still categorise them differently in saying that they're different species. So I was just wondering, like, at what point would we progress to the next species, because there's like there's relatively small differences between Erectus and Sapien, like there's compared to say Sapien and a whale. So what's the difference in Sapien and whatever we're going to call the next one?
Could be a real problem, couldn't it? I mean, I'm human, Mum, she's not. That's what happens somewhere if you're going to put a dividing line in.
Without getting too Wittgensteinian about it, it seems to me that we may here be trying to find a reportive definition for what is actually a stipulative definition. As the I think the Queen said in Alice in the Looking Glass, a word means what I choose it to mean. Now, it seems to me that you can perhaps stipulate a definition of human, which is completely valid, simply because that's what you agree the definition is, whereas a definition of an equilateral triangle is something quite different. A definition of an equilateral triangle is reported, and it's that's what the definition is forever. Whereas if we all in this room can agree to a definition of human, but somebody else may come to a completely different definition in the next room, and who do we know which is the most valid?
We can have a war about it. That's the traditional method of solving the problem.
My name's been Renee, and our marvellous profs, as always, so please raise the room one more time for our fantastic, fantastic panel. Trust me, I'm gutted to finish this here. I love this sparking that's happening, but please continue, stay, have a chat. But right now, once again, thank you so very much.